Hunter. Before I even announce the formal name of the talk, I just wanted to flash this TM picture. This is a TM image of self-organized quantum dot arrays. These are nanocrystals of cadmium selenide. This is 15 nanometers scale bar, so it's about 5 nanometer diameter, individual quantum dots. They're synthesized by means of colloidal chemistry, and you see that their size distribution is pretty homogeneous. It can be below 5% RMS, and then they're coated by some organic or inorganic coating and self-assembled on substrate. So it's possible, and this technique has been pioneered at the group of Munji Bavendi at MIT chemistry department, and they're able now, they're doing it for more than 5 years, for about 10 years, so now they've developed really good techniques. They actually can make stacked lattices, like artificial solids, basically, of very, very identical, usually 2-6 semiconducting crystals, like cadmium selenide, cadmium telluride, etc. So this will be the main sort of host material for the talk. The title is Anomalous Transport and Charge Ordering in Quantum Dot Arrays, and the theory has been done in collaboration with Leonid Levitov and some parts with Boris Kaczynski at MIT, and the dots were dots synthesized by Munji Bavendi group, and the experiments that I will be talking about, well, I'll be talking about theoretical models and certain experiments that are already going on in the group of Mark Kastner, done by Maria Derendich, the Papalardo fellow in his group, and Nicole Morgan, who has recently defended her thesis. So let me motivate this work. Well, first and foremost, this is a very interesting novel artificial system. Its properties are tunable in a broad range, and it's really good that this is a self-assembled system, so one can produce really large arrays of those things. This field has exploded, and instead of we have been always studying the these regular atoms in of atom regular lattices of atoms in the crystals, and now we're able to produce artificial atoms, quantum dots, and make what we want to make out of them. Well, not everything that we want, but we're going there, and these systems exhibit rich physics at all scales, and I'll try to talk a bit about it in my talk. Even single dot properties are extremely interesting. There have been measured, the fluorescence blinking statistics have been measured, and it appeared to be statistics with very large tails. And of course, in this dot arrays, the ordering, charge ordering can be non-trivial, because basically this is a triangular frustrated lattice, and one can study charge ordering on a frustrated lattice with a long-range Coulomb interaction between particles, which is interesting. And finally, transport measurements are the primary probe of properties of the systems, and I will be talking about possible charge ordering types that can be observed in these systems. This hasn't been yet done experimentally, and I'll be talking about dynamics, about transport at very large bias that is currently observed, and I'll be talking about certain.
This picture that you showed at the beginning.
Yes.
Are the dots fixed at positions, or they can move?
In principle, it's a soft system. So so the coating is organic. In principle, they can slowly move. Well, if for instance you anneal the sample, the sample a bit shrinks a bit, but they're not that much mobile. I mean, as soon as one can, I mean, it's hard to tell what happens there when say charges rearrange, but it seems to be that this is pretty much a solid, but one can shrink it, for instance, by annealing. So people actually anneal these samples to make, if they want to study transport, they want to make these tunneling barriers between the dots smaller, so they anneal and the dots become a bit closer to each other. But it's a small, relatively small effect.
The dispersion is about 5%,
right? RMS, yes, which corresponds to one atomic layer. They're really identical. This is amazing. I will talk a bit about how they synthesize.
Sure, there's no
effect. Yeah. Well, this is a relatively small sample now. What they studied transport on much worse samples, but that's not, it's not a fundamental problem. It's rather, I would say, organizational problem. They can make it better. They're going to. So the outline is, first I will talk about experiment, then I'll talk about some theory and some basically Monte Carlo simulations of to classify charged ordering types and draw the phase diagram of charges ordering on this ideal triangular lattice of sites. And that's basically a work aimed at future experiments, which are not yet done. And then I'll talk about current state of events. I'll talk about transport large bias, talk about experiments, and they yield rather bizarre results. And I'll tell you these results, and then I'll tell you about some phenomenological rather simple transport model which we've concocted to integrate all these results that are known. So let me first talk about the setup. So this quantum dot array is placed on the silicon substrate between the gold electrodes, and the transport is measured across the array. The dots are synthesized, let me talk about it. Basically, it's a chemical methods of synthesizing the dots. You inject with a syringe the precursors of cadmium and selenide into the hot solution, and you make the concentration of precursors just a bit the nucleation threshold. And so the nucleation starts and the concentration drops below the nucleation threshold, and now the phase of very slow growth starts. And so the growth of the nanocrystals in the solution is very slow. For instance, 10 nanometer size correspond to a couple of hours, as far as I remember. So which makes very easy to size select, because waiting longer you get larger dots, and then they're able to size select them even better and get this 5% RMS dispersion of sizes, and then they put them into another solution and coat them. So it's all chemical means, and then this coated dots, this organic coating is about 1 nanometer thick, and then they deposit this solution of coated dots on some substrate where they want them to be, and if they do it carefully and slowly, then the solution slowly evaporates, and the dots find their ways to rearrange and to make themselves into this rather perfect lattices. And here the growth wasn't that perfect. The rearrangement wasn't this perfect, so that's basically one monolayer, right? This avoids the substrate, and these are the dots, and somewhere here the second monolayer wants to grow. So this is not the best quality sample. And experimentally, they study transport on sort of stacked layers. They have about 50 layers of these things, so they're actually not really two-dimensional. We want them to be two-dimensional, but it seems to be harder. And the sizes can be varied in a rather large range, and the temperature is liquid nitrogen, 7K. And there is a back gate which can control the charge density on this arrays. And since it's basically rather high temperature by modern standards, this is basically, essentially, it's a classical Hopping incoherent tunneling of charges on the edges and dots, and say transport is due to this incoherent Hopping.
In the left,
Yes, yes, this is basically this is deposited on the whole sample, but if this is source and this is drain, that's pretty much what you measure only across the electrode. And the gate, you know, the gate can be large, can be small. They do different samples. They study conductivity as a function of gate voltage, etc. I'll talk about the experimental results like in half an hour. Okay. So let me first talk briefly about some somewhat old work of ours. If one views the charges on the dot arrays as charges on the sides of ideal triangular lattice, and I'll just want to study charge ordering types and draw a phase diagram of the system, the main tool will be to map this problem onto classical triangularizing anti-ferromagnet with long-range Coulomb interactions.
When you say that in the sample you actually have many layers, so how do the layers stack on top of each other? Are they ordered in some particular shape?
They're too disordered for that to matter, at least today. So this is all idealized. And I'll talk about the present state of experiment later. So, I mean, in principle, you can make one layer. And once again, it's not an unsolvable problem. I think it's just more or less, you know, the matter of priorities, what they want to do first, what they want to do second. I'll expect much more experiments to come. Yes, yes. In fact, Bavendi was making several layers, rather well stacked. So, like the chemists were trying to make all possible things. I don't know what exactly is the state of affairs now, but even a couple of years ago, it was rather impressive.
But the dots, the arrays in the experiment that show these low relaxations, everything, are these well ordered states where in the stack, or are they?
The transport experiments, the arrays that are used in transport experiments, are rather poor quality. Mm-hmm. They're in principle rather disordered objects. So they have like on average 50 layers, but they have very good orientational order only locally. And then, you know, if you go like 10 dots away, your triangular lattice is already, you know.
Even on the single layer?
Yes, I think even on the single layer. Yes, yes. So the first image I showed you, it was the state of the art, let me first tell you briefly what we expect if one has the ideal triangular lattice of sides in such a geometry. So we consider ideal two-dimensional triangular lattice, and the dots are small, so and the density charge density on the sample is rather low, so that we expect that double occupancy can be easily forbidden. And then what we describe the system by basically classical energy of charges, Coulomb energy of these charges on the sides. And in principle, one can have a gate voltage coupled to the total charge and some random disorder potential. And we take any realistic Coulomb or scream Coulomb interactions, and we will talk about Monte Carlo simulations, for instance, to study ordering and conductivity in these samples. And Hopping is incoherent. Hopping occurs between the adjacent sites, and it's incoherent tunneling.
What is the volume of
the random potential? Well, it can be the substrate, first of all. It's, you know, realistically, it's a silicon oxide. So it can be just offset charge there. Now you can, if these are layers, then of course the other layers can also affect it. In principle, it can be anything. We don't really. I won't focus on disorder here that much. I mean, we can discuss it. But,
The electric constant, does it matter that you have this medium that has the getting so in my dots that have the electric constant, and then you have the polymers, the thing in between,
uh-huh.
Right, that has another dielectric constant. So you see some sort of evidence long distances.
See, we can talk about it all, but in principle, what's we just use one parameter. In principle, we normalize everything to the energy of nearest neighbor interactions. And the thing which is most important in the phase diagram that I'll talk about is that the interaction is long range. So there is next nearest and beyond neighbors. And it doesn't really matter whether it's 1 over r or it's, you know, 1 over r cubed, or we're using Yukawa potential just to see what happens, etc. So it seems that some results are sort of universal, at least. I mean, quality. Uh-huh. This is not a variable range, if that's what you mean. No, the thing is that this is essentially the essential properties of this is due to triangular lattice, due to frustration, and I'll tell you more about it. This is actually very, very important. So let me use the language of mapping of the system on the triangular Ising antiferromagnet. Basically, as soon as we forbid double occupancy of sites, the mapping is trivial. One can map occupied site to spin up, unoccupied to spin down, and then the Coulomb repulsion between like charges yields the antiferromagnetic sign of spin interactions. And spin models have been studied in different contexts for a long time. The main difference that's actually crucial here, and that will be crucial in the phase diagram, is that the interaction is explicitly long range. It's antiferromagnetic due to Coulomb repulsion, but it's long range. And usually spin models are short range. For instance, the relevant model for us could be the exactly solved triangular Ising antiferromagnet at zero field. And this is, of course, nearest neighbor, Stephenson and Vanier. And then one can map gate voltage to external field and random field to random potential, etc. So what's so interesting about this frustrated lattices is that basically the elementary lattice triangle has three vertices, but we have only two kinds of, well, either spins or charges in our language. And so it's impossible to set, even in the near, let's suppose that we have the nearest neighbor interactions only. So on any such triangle, it's impossible to place the charges so that they would satisfy all the bonds. So at least one of the bonds will cost energy. And so it's easy to guess that in ground state, all these triangles would like to pair, to share one frustrated bond, to minimize the number of frustrated bonds. And so what one does, one erases from the picture the frustrated bonds and gets a covering of the two-dimensional plane by a rhombi, like shown here. So basically, this is one-to-one mapping charges to the covering of the plane by a rhombi. And in the ground state, there are, at certain densities, there are a lot of these configurations, and entropy can be extensive. So in fact, yes. Yes. So the ground states, when you have long range interactions, actually it will be frozen into certain commensurate configurations. That's one of the main differences. I'll talk about it. So. Yeah, but this is modulus subtracting basically the overall Coulomb, zero mode of the Coulomb potential. S equals 2q minus 1, and interaction between Qs will be interaction between S, and then modulo overall constant. It will be, you know, rescaling the parameters, it will be the same. So.
Actually, just to clarify one. So, uh-huh. If voltage is such, the concentration is considered?
Well, the concentration could be anything, right?
Suppose concentration is so big that all of them are.
Right. So exactly. So it's a good point. So we study the concentration range between 1/3 and 2/3. Because this is where the most interesting charge ordering types occur, where in the ground state one can have a perfect covering of the plane. Of course. So at any density between 1/3 and 2/3, at zero temperature, one can cover the whole plane. In the way similar to this, and for instance, for nearest neighbor interaction case, this will be one of the many ground states. So, for instance, this is density 1/2, but you know, density, I don't know, 3/5 or whatever will look pretty much the same.
So here
I'll just erase all the frustrated bonds. So these are occupied sites, these are unoccupied sites, and I erased bonds between likely occupied sites. And so what's remarkable about frustrated lattices. If the interaction is nearest range character, there are a lot of ground states, and for instance, Hopf's of the charge here doesn't cost you any energy. So the system is essentially fluid. So that's why, if you hop from here to here, you do not make any new frustrated bonds. And so if the interaction isn't of the nearest neighbor kind, then this hop doesn't cost you any energy. So in ground state, at zero temperature, in this model, the entropy is extensive.
But
uh-huh.
These things are localized. I mean, can you, by hopping through states which don't go temperature, can you go from one side?
Of course, and that's why this will have a conductivity. In fact, this will conduct, you know, it will probably have infinite conductivity. Of course, if you have a longer range interaction, then these hops will cost you some energy, which is of the order of next nearest neighbor interaction. So the conductivity will be finite, and I'll talk about it.
Probably with the exception of some commensurate phases, which are solid.
Exactly, 1/3 over 2/3, which is √3/√3. So let me first. So I'm studying between 1/3 and 2/3, and well, actually one want to study between 1/3 and 1/2, because everything else is electron hole symmetry equivalent. Yes.
Suppose I'm very close to 1/3.
Right.
Yes, 1/3 plus
it. Exactly.
Then Igor is correct that I first choose my ground state, mm-hmm. and then for the rest of the electrons I have Coulomb.
Why is that? The charges, for instance, if the interaction is short range, then this extra charges will hop on the frozen background almost freely. I don't have this order, at least I'm not talking about it now. So. In principle, you can add small disorder potential, and it seems that disorder doesn't, at least. Disorder, at least in Monte Carlo simulations, is a relatively small disorder that seemed not to change qualitatively, for instance, the conductivity. And that's because of this extensive entropy. And that's because of this frustration. And well, for generic density, let me say so. Say, for what half?
There are several of them, but
yeah.
Just you getting from one to another requires shifting whole system.
Right, but let me talk more. I'll show you
what.
Yes, I'll show you more 1/3 in a minute. So let me just finish with the mapping. I will basically talk about the system, mapping it to the height field order parameter. Basically, I can look at the system not as the pairing of the plane by rhombi, but as the projection of the rough cubic crystal along the main diagonal of the cube. So basically, I hope everybody can see this. Basically, this is a surface of a rough cubic crystal projected along on the two-dimensional plane by along the main diagonal. And so, one instead of studying the rearrangement of charges, one can study the dynamics, the fluctuations of this height variable on the large scale. And this will be our main tool. And this is what's called mapping to solid on solid model. And as I've said, even at low temperature, if the system is not frozen, there can be this hops. Basically, all the charge rearrangements happens via this correlated hops, which correspond to removing or adding these two elementary cubic cells to this fictitious cubic rough cubic surface. And this is the main mechanism of conductivity in this correlated state. However, when you raise the temperature, you can you add frustrated ones. And it's interesting that you get this sort of triangles, large triangles. And let me just show you one of them. Basically, if you focus on one of them, you can see that now it's impossible to define the height globally. This is now a screw dislocation in the height. And by going around the triangle, you get a mismatch in height, which is two lengths of the diagonal of this fictitious cube.
How is the height defined here?
Well, the height is a projection. So if you view this as a surface of a rough cubic crystal projected on the two-dimensional surface, then the height is the height of your cubic crystal, right? And now this is a screw dislocation because now you can't define the height. For instance, if you have these defects are actually topological because they originate and disappear in pairs as screw dislocations. They now going around two of them, you can define the height globally. So these defects are topological, and now you can ask all these questions whether there can be a dislocation binding transition of the Kostritz-Tallis type, etc. So let me address the question of Boris and talk about different possible ordering types. So that's what happens at 1/3. Exactly, this is a commensurate root 3 by root 3 structure. Of course, it doesn't conduct. Well, it can't be anything. I mean, we're using the same language to discuss ordering. So let's suppose it's long range. So it turns out that the ground state at density 1/3 is this lattice. Now, if you add a bit of charge, extra charge, so it's 1/3 plus epsilon. That's what you were asking. So you get this charges, extra charges, right? And okay, if it's nearest neighbor, then this can hop freely without creating new dislocation pairs. So it's actually, this hop doesn't cost any energy. Well, if the interaction is longer range, then of course this hop would cost the energy, which is of the order of Coulomb interaction between the other free charges.
Are you very density of chemical potential? Because in this language, even with the magnetic field, there's a chemical.
Right.
So you can vary the chemical potential without adding any charge for a while.
Exactly. Well, we're using both languages. So for instance, for conductivity, it's better to fix the density and see how what would be the conductivity at certain density. I'll draw the phase diagram as a function of chemical potential and temperature because that's the most natural thing to do. So density 1/2 I've already shown, and these are the dislocation pairs if you raise the temperature. And if you raise the temperature even further, you create a lot of frustrated bonds. And so you have a lot of dislocation. So the height variable is torn apart, and it's no longer a very good way to describe the system. So let me show you the phase diagram, and that's basically the main result of this part of the talk. What we find is that this is temperature, this is chemical potential. At very large temperature, you have a lot of frustrated bonds, so you have basically a disordered phase. Charges are completely uncorrelated. Now, you lower the temperature, you get this correlated phase, where there is, at least in the finite system, there is always a very good covering of the system by rhombi, so there is always a well-defined height. There, in principle, can be certain dislocations by a Boltzmann factor. In fact, we don't find the Kosteritz-Tauless binding transition of the dislocation pairs. So formally, height doesn't exist here, but for any finite system, the Boltzmann probability of having dislocation pairs is negligible. So in our simulation, we can define height everywhere here very well. And this here, the conductivity occurs due to these correlated hops that do not ruin this height variable. And so we predict the conductivity, which has a correlated nature, in essentially the classical system. And this is just due to geometrical frustration. That's why this triangular lattice is extremely important in this case, right? And so if you lower the temperature even further, basically you get the main difference between long-range and short-range model, because in this long-range model, the system actually freezes into commensurate states corresponding to different rational densities. And we study the most pronounced ones, one-thirds and one-half. In principle, there will be pockets for corresponding to any rational filling, but it's just much harder to find them. I mean, I found 3/7 during simulations. It took like a day on the computer. So and so there is no Brzezinski-Kosteritz-Tauless phase transition here, and the freezing occurs via first-order phase transitions. So this is basically the novelty from the short-range spin case. And I mean, I can.
The effects of the phase transition, it's a different order. You basically can also say that there are no phonons in the solid state.
Phonons. There's no phonons in the model.
That's known even in triangularizing antiferromagnetic elastic.
Yes, like Kardar and Chen, exactly. When the interaction is long enough range, you can have a first order. Yes. So okay. Okay. First of all, so you're right in the sense that in two dimensions, fluctuations can ruin your first order transition. So I mean, first of all, for all these densities, we find the cubic invariance in the free energy expansion. Now, whether you can believe the Landau theory or not in two dimensions, you have to basically do some checks and using Monte Carlo simulations. And we try to use Monte Carlo simulations to see how well it freezes, how sharply it freezes, basically. Yeah, but this is infinite range interactions. Here it's, well, basically Coulomb.
So it's the elastic distortion is 1 over R cubed interaction.
1 over R squared, 1 over R
squared. Yeah. Because here it would be 1 over R cubed.
If it's.
I'm just saying there's one instance where even in 2D.
Yes.
But there's a big difference between 1 over R cubed
and 1 over R cubed. I'm not so sure.
No, because.
Igor, let me say so. What we find is the following.
Changes a lot of our intuition about what can happen.
Okay, I agree. And so what we do is the following. One thing that we do is we measure the rigidity of the height field fluctuation. So the fluctuation of the height field is Gaussian above the transition and sharply drops, basically rigidity becomes infinite in the transition. What we also do, we accumulate the histograms of energy in the finite system. I mean, the patch is like 20 by 20, it's not that large, but that's what we can do on the PC. And we, having the histograms, then we can find what's an average energy, what's and other Boltzmann moments of the presumably Boltzmann distribution, and compare. So first of all, we find that the energy may, at least at one third, makes a drop, and it becomes sharper as the system size grows larger, and then the heat capacity, which is related to the second moment of this distribution, makes sort of a delta functional peak, and this is the derivative. But these are not the derivatives of these functions. These are independent moments. And so by checking that this is a good derivative of this, you can actually check whether your system is at equilibrium using Monte Carlo. This is also a good consistency check. So at least at one third, for me, it's pretty pronounced first order transition. I mean, it's not infinitely sharp because the system is not that large. But it's becoming sharper with the larger system size. For one half, it's not that conclusive because it's hard to freeze the one-half density into a good flat configuration of a Hyatt field corresponding to this commensurate state. So with one-half, I'm not that sure. So the cubic invariants are there, and the fluctuations can be large. Whether they will change it or not, you know, if I would believe that if interaction is long-range enough, that it will be first order. Now, what I want to talk in this context is also the sort of suggestion how to experimentally see these charge ordering types. And this is basically about low bias conductivity. If you measure the conductivity, of course, in the commensurate states, it's zero. And we find that, of course, it's a natural result that the conductivity for different densities drops to sharply to zero at the freezing point. So this is what we suggest as a primarily a way to find experimentally this ordered types. Okay. Say it again.
What is A?
A? Ah, the previous tense. The conductivity. It's a lattice constant. So basically, this is some universal 1 over temperature dependence from the classical fluctuation dissipation theorem that we find an agreement with. So to also to check that our Monte Carlo is, you know, that we're at equilibrium. Okay. There are no phonons. It's an ideal lattice.
But how latent comes from one side to the other side?
It can hop on in the model. It can hop to the neighboring side. It hops with a basically Boltzmann probability. You calculate the energy before hop. You calculate the energy after the hop, and then you use some Entropolis rule. Yes. So you have a temperature. Yes, they're fictitious. Yes, but in principle, well, in the real system, of course, you need some energy relaxation mechanism, and presumably it is phonons. Because what else can it be?
What we are simulating is just dying.
Well, yeah. Right. So basically, it's a Monte Carlo. We do not know the phonon spectrum. So in principle, the conductivity as a function of temperature can also be multiplied by some power law function of temperature, which tells you about particular phonon relaxation mechanism. But we do not do it because we, I mean, in the.
What's assumed here is that energy relaxation is the quickest process.
Exactly. Right. Correct. And we want to basically just to study singularities, and they wouldn't affect whether you multiply by some regular function of temperature, because at this temperature nothing would happen with your phonons. So what we want to study is basically that we want to basically check, and this is pretty obvious, that the conductivity in the commensurate state will drop to zero, and this is the simplest statement that one can check whether you have ordering types, as if, say, a function, you vary gate voltage, and you measure zero bias conductivity, and you find at certain temperatures the singularities. And we're predicting that they will find the singularities corresponding to ordering types if the lattice is ideal enough. Okay. And one can also study conductivity as a function of density, and basically study freezing in the commensurate states. Because there is a finite, we study basically zero bias conductivity, well, as zero as you can do it in Monte Carlo. And if you have a commensurate state, you have a finite gap of, basically the gap is of the order of adding frustrated bonds in the one-third. In one-half, it's less, because it's more or less defined by the near, by the second nearest, next nearest neighbor.
Put it a little bit in perspective. Some time ago, several talks here about why Ledesalle and Diamashev and Kai Racer about elastic media moving between
Okay.
The only problem was there was disorder.
Uh-huh.
And is this problem different?
Well, I haven't heard this talk, so I wasn't here.
But your gap has to do with creating the dislocations, right?
Yes, yes.
So
well, not well, at certain densities. At small densities, it's basically second nearest.
You have this commensurate phase, which cannot move anything without creating.
At this point, you have no disorder.
Yeah. There is no real disorder. I mean, we can study the effect of small disorder in this correlated phase, where the system is not frozen. And what we find is that qualitatively, the fluctuations, at least with small enough disorder, are still Gaussian.
Okay. I have a feeling that having incremental concentration is more or less equivalent.
Boris, it's a frustrated lattice. The system is rather fluid. It can actually, so it's interesting that if you introduce random, you know, in your Monte Carlo, random offset charge on sites, right? That in this sort of Gaussian phase where the height surface fluctuates freely, nothing qualitatively actually changes. Well, the stiffness might change a bit, but we don't see any sharp changes, at least with small enough disorder. And so we understand it intuitively as basically the fact that due to this extensive entropy, the system can sort of flow around, because there are all these hops that do not create dislocation pairs, and they cost very few energy. If the interactions of the nearest type, they cost zero energy at all. And so basically, that's what frustration gives you. Okay. Let me conclude this part of my talk. We have found this correlated phase with which exhibits collective behavior in essentially classical system due to frustrations. No Brzezinski-Kosterlitz-Dallas transition, freezing presumably via the first order transitions, and conductivity suggested as a zero bias conductivity suggested as a probe of charge ordering. Now let me briefly talk about the real world, which is much more complex and much more bizarre, and we go far from what this ideal model that I've been talking about. In reality, this transport happens in rather disordered arrays, irregular arrays, and the most important thing is that presumably due to thick tunneling barriers between agents and sites, these dot arrays are extremely resistive. They actually are probably one of the most resistive objects that is known. People have been measured relaxation of charge, basically diffusion propagator, and they found that diffusion constant is of the order of 1 micrometer squared per minute or something. It's extremely resistive.
So this would be because of frustration, you know,
charge to be, not because of the tunneling.
I would say that the tunneling actually is small, because maybe the energy relaxation is small due to lack of phonons, so maybe phonon bottleneck, and it's probably the tunneling barriers, I think. So in reality, to see any current, any reasonable current, they have to apply 100 volts per sample, which has, say, 200 dots. So the bias that they apply now is actually larger than the dot charging energy. So it's completely non-stationary, non-zero bias regime, right? So, you know, it's reasonable that our theory doesn't apply in this case. But what I want to just share some interesting, rather bizarre experimental findings in this regime, which they have been studying for already probably 3 years. And what they find consistently is rather bizarre. So they switch on this huge voltage at time equals to zero, and they hold it. And they measure current. And the current is given by a power law as a function of time. So the current decays, but it decays in such a way that the net integrated charge diverges. So this power law is always between 0 and 1, so that the total charge transmitted is divergent. And already for the time scales that they have probed, it's orders of magnitude larger than the upper estimate for the charge that is capacitively accumulated on the array. So it's a real transport across the system. But it's extremely strange, because they've tested it over 5 decades in time, from hundreds of milliseconds to days, to I think maximum was more than 10 hours. And they see this power law. The power law is non-universal, depends on the sample, on everything, but all samples, qualitative features are the same. Also, they find memory effects. If you switch off the voltage and then wait for a bit and repeat the measurement, you find the same power law, but with a smaller amplitude. And if you, the longer you wait between your successive measurements, the closer the amplitude will be to the original one. So the amplitude is restored if you wait longer between the measurements, or if you anneal the sample, or if you apply a band gap light. So if you sufficiently, you know, jam the sample, you can restore the amplitude. So this is some weird memory.
It's only perhaps in the charge rearrangements, which are very small.
Okay.
Right?
So okay, good point. So let me first tell you that I'll address your question. So this power law, as I said, is non-universal. It depends on the nature of the dots, cadmium selenide, cadmium telluride, etc., and the nature of the cover, capping layers, the size of them, the gate thickness, on many factors. A bit on temperature, but not much. But qualitative features are the same. It's a power law on a very broad time scales, and it's a very good power law. You clearly have, so to address your point, you clearly have a non-stationary response, basically to switching on the constant voltage. So one can say that you drive a system with a stationary voltage, and you get the non-stationary response on a very large variety of timescales. So one can look at it differently. So one way is what you suggest is that the system's properties are non-stationary, whether it's charge rearrangements, whether dots sort of shift a bit because it's a soft chemical system, or maybe the system somewhere locally reheats or cools down, maybe there is some kind of aging of the organic capping barriers, etc. However, it's somewhat, I would say, unnatural, at least to me, that this happens in such a way. So supposedly, you know, the conductivity of the system changes with time. It's sort of unnatural to me that the conductivity changes with time as an ideal power law on this broad variation of time scales. So to sort of get around this, we decided to propose a phenomenological model which essentially does not require non-stationarity of the system's parameters. So we I'll describe a model on the next transparency, which is phenomenological. So of course it doesn't tell you anything about microscopics. We can, you know, speculate about it later, but which assumes statistically stationary systems properties that can yield non-stationary response. So bizarre as it sounds, it's actually possible. So let me describe this phenomenological model. We view the conductivity through the array as basically we view this sample, this gold electrodes, as a large number of independent identical conducting channels. So this is complete phenomenology. Don't ask me about microscopic origin yet. So let's suppose that the conductivity happens by large number of parallel conducting channels, and this is reasonable to assume because this is about 1 micrometer, and this is this is about 1 millimeter actually, and this is about, hold on, this is a micron, this is 1,000 microns. So the aspect ratio is 1,000 to 1. So this is probably pretty reasonable. And then let's focus on a single channel if they're all independent. We assume that the current in a single channel is a combination of short peaks, and these peaks correspond to transmission events of a unit charge. And the channel is almost always closed, and it opens for a small time and transmits a unit charge. And we assume that this transmission events are uncorrelated with each other. So in this case, this channel can be completely characterized by a waiting time distribution of this transmission events. So build a distribution function of this intervals between successive transmissions. And
What determines the waiting? I mean, if a channel conducts and it has to wait to rest.
Okay, so let me explain. So suppose sort of a natural case is to take some Poissonian waiting time distribution. In this case, there will be a well-defined average waiting time, which can be determined by some microscopics. I don't want to talk about microscopics now. I will talk about it in 5 minutes. Okay. If you have a Poissonian distribution, then of course, if you wait long, the charge, the average charge, will be time over the waiting time. Of the average waiting time, right? And so, which corresponds to constant current, right? However, in our case, the current is not constant. We assume that the waiting time distribution is of this Levy form, which basically corresponds to a very long tail for large waiting times. So we assume that this distribution is of this form asymptotically. And mu is between 0 and 1, so it can be normalized, but already first moment diverges. So this distribution doesn't have moments. And if the average waiting time is infinite, right, then this intuition no longer applies. If you switched on the voltage infinitely early in the past, then by now, since you have an infinitely large waiting time, the current will be 0. However, you switch the voltage on at time equals to 0. Now, the longer you wait, the larger waiting times you allow in the system. So statistically, time independent, this is a function of the waiting time only. It's not the function of time. So the system with this characterized by a stationary stochastic process can exhibit non-stationary response just due to this non-Gaussian, non-Poissonian statistics. And this Levy processes that violate central limit theorem occur in different systems that characterized by, say, a very different broad range of time scales, from transports in amorphous solids to earthquake distribution, time distributions of aftershocks, to stock market fluctuations, to they occur in different, very different contexts. For our case, what's interesting is that if you say simulate the charge that has passed after time t, then in a single channel, the charge is dominated by very large fluctuations because you have infinite average waiting time, mean value for the waiting time. So the fluctuations in this single channel will be extremely large. In fact, one can prove easily that the variance in charge scales as average charge squared, contrarily to what you would expect from the central limit theorem. From the central limit theorem, you would expect this first power. And here it's to the average charge squared. So the relative fluctuation does not decay with increasing the net charge. So this is very rough function. However, if you average over a large number of independent parallel conducting channels, you'll get rather smooth function that can give you the power law in decaying current. Now, so what our parameter is this mu of the waiting time distribution that is related to this observed power law is basically 1 minus mu. At this moment, you shouldn't trust me at all because this is one of the, of course, good. Okay, good, very good, very good. Because this is, you know, so what, right? So this can be one of like 1,000 possible ways of how to put a non-stationary power law of current decay in the system. So you have to have some independent prediction by this model and compare it with some independent measurement to at least start trusting it, okay? So what can be the independent prediction? Well, noise is a signal, and we basically derive what is the power law spectrum of the noise that we expect in, if the system is indeed described by this Levy statistics. And so I told you about the noise at zero frequency. It's actually sort of technically harder to compare with experiments, so we derive the expression for the noise at finite frequency. And the finite frequency noise is indeed non-Poissonian. It's a power law. It's essential that this power law is basically frequency to the power minus mu, and mu is this parameter of the Levy distribution. And what's essential is that basically noise power law spectrum is given by the same power law as the Fourier of average current. And this is a very simple statement which can be then tested experimentally. And
I assume you can connect the mu with the exponent you measure for the current as a function of time, right?
Yes, it's 1 minus mu.
It's 1 minus
mu. Yeah. So basically, that's what we told last summer. That's what we told to our experimental colleagues and asked them to measure noise and current in the same system. So they made 200 measurements on the same. I'm not sure because the central limit theorem doesn't work. I don't have a good intuition whether what would be related to what. This is a result of a calculation. Since this is weird, I don't want to trust my intuition. So this is a calculation. This is a prediction. Let's go measure. They've accumulated statistics of measurements of current on the same sample in the same cryostat without jamming it, accumulated a couple of hundred measurements and then discarded like first 100 or so because there were large memory effects, so they wanted to the system to sort of be with less memory effects. And then these averages were performed then over this independent experimental realizations. The system is obviously not in equilibrium if you have the 100 volts applied across the sample. This will be some factor of time. The time that has passed can be related to average current by power law.
Okay.
So this will be, of course, some. This will be a function also of the total measurement time. Yes, sure, sure. So, but when they fix the time, say 100 seconds, and they measure a lot of measurements on the same system, a current for the 100 seconds window, and they calculate this averages over the realizations. Okay? Current, noise. And the power law is about 0.72, mu is 0.72, which corresponds to alpha 0.3. And this has been done for one sample only, but this sample it's rather representative, it's cadmium selenide with organic coating. And for comparison, I have drawn one RF noise just to tell you that this noise is not one RF. What's important is not that it is a power law, but is this coincidence of two power laws, which might suggest that actually this model is not completely insane.
Is it trying to relate this, right, even if it's a artificial equilibrium fluctuation, dissipation relation, and effective temperature? Could you do that and see if the temperature agrees with the...
I didn't do this way. I basically... I'm uncomfortable to use the fluctuation-dissipation relation in the context when the system is so away from equilibrium.
But you could see at least that if it's the same relation but with the wrong temperature.
Well, I don't know. But does fluctuation-dissipation theorem give you the power law fluctuations?
No, I think that if I look at the...
I didn't do that. The short answer, I didn't do that. We can discuss it later.
What is the mu of this graph?
0.7. 0.72, I guess. Right.
My feeling is that this very slight picture is kind of in contradiction with this story about translation.
These are two completely different...
This was
for zero bias, and here the bias is larger than the dot charging energy, and the sample is disordered.
What I want to tell is that if this is true, then
right.
What you were speaking about in the first half is kind of irrelevant to what they're doing.
No, because the picture that I have for this transport in this large bias regime, I mean, we can talk about my... I would say that the microscopic mechanism for this that I seem to, well, that it seems more probable than anything else that I know of, is quite different, I would say, from what I was expecting for the zero bias conductivity on the regular lattice. And I don't assume any triangular lattice. This is a phenomenology. I can speculate a bit about the microscopic origin of this thing. For that, let me talk a bit just for 1 minute about the experiments, optical experiments on the same system. What they have been doing is they have been studying fluorescence intermittency of the individual dot, and the fluorescence intermittency exhibited this also Levy statistics. Basically, you start shining laser light at time equals to zero, and you look at the dot fluorescing, a single dot, and they find that the on and off, so they find that the dot is blinking, so the dot can be on, fluorescing, or off, not fluorescing. And this distributions of both on times and off times scale as a power law, and described by the same Levy, by a similar Levy distribution with mu about 0.5, from 0.4 to 0.6.
Single dot.
Single dot, exactly. So the picture that they have in mind is the following. Maybe this is the, there is, so the dot is in some chemical environment, and you excite an exciton on the dot by the laser light, and then the electron can tunnel on some, you know, impurity level nearby in the chemical environment. And then the dot is off because then the hole cannot recombine. And then the electron can hop again, and then the dot will recombine. So since probably there is some bottleneck for the energy relaxation in this case, then the tunneling might occur well only when the level of this impurity is aligned with the level of the electron. And if you're shining the laser light, it's basically drive it out of equilibrium, then there can be a diffusion in energy of the mutual difference between these energy levels. And now, if you calculate the weight and time distribution of one-dimensional diffusion, Gaussian diffusion, basically of weight and time distributions for the successive returns to the origin in one-dimensional Gaussian diffusion, you'll get 3/2. So mu is 1/2. And this is a classical result. So they were obtaining mu's about from 0.4 to 0.6, I guess, in these samples. And this has been done by, I think, several groups. So maybe this relates to this, our conjecture is maybe this can relate, this statistics of the excited state on the dot can relate to this anomalous transport at a very large bias.
In the first model, you didn't put any levels at all.
This is completely. Yeah, but these two stories sort of are very different because the assumptions are very different. So the experiment now is done at a very large bias, and there I assume basically zero bias Hopping. So I don't want to connect them. In fact, what we did, we had this Monte Carlo algorithm at hand, and we tried to actually apply a very large voltage and see how the system transmits, say, when it's frozen, but the bias is very large. And you indeed get this combination of peaks in current corresponding to basically avalanches of charges through the same system. However, it was inconclusive. You want to study the long tail in the distribution, and on a PC you really cannot accumulate good enough statistics to find whether it seemed like a power law. But say, if you integrate all the charge, it was growing almost linearly just because there was some sort of correlation. The longer you wait, the larger avalanche you get.
You put energy levels on each dog.
We didn't do that, but. I don't want to talk about microscopic mechanism now because there is basically not enough experimental information about the system yet. These were about the only measurements that have been done. The only other measurement was to study the charge relaxation on the large scale at room temperature, where all this doesn't really happen. So this is completely different regimes. We asked them to, and they're saying that they will do charge relaxation at nitrogen temperature. Maybe this also can, maybe this, then you can distinguish this charge relaxation diffusion propagator, whether it will correspond to anomalous diffusion or not. I don't know. But that's about only experiments that are, I can talk about with confidence. And you have to address the system somehow. So that's different approaches that we tried. I expect much more information in the years to come. So let me conclude. I'm sorry, I'm a bit over time. We can consider novel self-assembled system with very rich physics on different scales, and we suggest that transport, and particularly noise, is a probe of the properties, and we've shown that one can have a non-stationary response in a statistically stationary system due to a very fat tail in the weight and time distribution. And one of the experiments that can clarify the matter is maybe to study optical and electrical measurements on essentially the same dots, the same system. Maybe If these exponents coincide, maybe this can actually tell us something about the excited state on the dots. And of course, there are not so many well-defined experimental results, so there are more questions than answers. If you have questions, I'll try to answer, but I don't expect to answer all of them because this is a new field without much information known. Thank you. You basically have a very rough. So the first question is easy. You basically just have a larger prefactor in the noise. So averaging over a large number of independent channels doesn't qualitatively do anything. It just reduces the noise by one over square root of n. Here, the central limit theorem works because this is an ensemble. What about percolation? Honestly, I haven't thought about this. The system size is about 200 dots across. Whether this is enough to talk about backbone or not, I'm not sure.
But if you take your data
right.
and try to extract number of channels from this experiment,
it's hard because there is also some time measurement time prefactor in front of the noise. And this sort of relates to some microscopic cutoff. So I thought about it. I really couldn't find a good procedure to estimate the number of channels. So it really depends on the measurement time. And I think you have to sort of have some, it's basically a function of time over some microscopic cutoff. So I can't. To divide one over another, say. Probably yes. That's a good idea. That's a good idea. I would say that this just would require larger statistics for the measurement. And what we have been doing, I was actually assisting in the lab. I was pouring liquid nitrogen in the cryostat. So it took more than 24 hours to accumulate the statistics. And I mean, we can probably do better. Of course, yeah, but that hasn't been done yet. Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
has this distribution of timescale. Imagine if you could do measurement transport in a single dot. Would the noise that current also show that you have this distribution of timescales for coming in and out?
It may be if what you have I think to assume some sort of dirt nearby. Some impurity levels where the charge can hop.
Well, let's say just the leads. So it's in and out, so just a little.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about the microscopic mechanism. So one can think that this sort of bottleneck, which corresponds to diffusion of the levels due to transport, happens, say, at one dot across this. Channel of like 200 dots across. So it may be due to some potential drop, non-homogeneous potential drop, here is the bottleneck. And maybe that's where it happens. But I don't know, probably the contact, the leads will actually ruin this picture.
What about that just being the setting the time scale for, you know, when you think about the hopping,
mm-hmm.
could be that hopping, the hopping time.
You know, if you get a rate, then it's not this. But the essential thing is you don't have a rate because you have a distribution of hopping times which doesn't have a time scale.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a definitive thing to check, I think. But I don't know whether the leads will actually, you know, sort of intrude too heavily into these measurements.
Mm-hmm.
But that hasn't been done. The short answer, I don't know, because it hasn't been done. Yeah, I don't know.
There are no more questions. Let's speak again.